Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam, we get to talk with Dr. Danielle Ofri, Associate Professor at New York University School of Medicine and Editor-in-Chief of Bellevue Literary Review, about her new book, What Doctors Feel.
Doctors have feelings?
How are you feeling today, Adam?
We can't ever disclose our feelings, Christy. That would be undoctor-like.
I know. We're supposed to listen to other people's feelings, right?
Well, we're going to find out and have this kind of conversation, and I'm excited. I guess that's a feeling about it. But first, we have some feelings, or at least some research that matters that we can express some feelings about.
Absolutely. We're going to start first with a study about delayed umbilical cord clamping when babies are born, but we'll also talk about exercise and obesity.
About concussions in teenagers.
And lastly, about how faith can affect therapy.
Oh, no. I can see those feelings coming right up. Well, let's dive right into this very first study about delaying cutting of the umbilical cord after delivery. Tell us a little bit about why this is an important issue, Christy.
So the context here is that for decades and decades, doctors have delivered the baby and then quickly cut the umbilical cord to separate the baby from that cord and the mother.
The quicker the better is what I was taught.
Yeah, that you're kind of
you're so nervous. Get it done, right.
But for many years, at least in our practice, we've had many patients wanting us to delay that clamping, to put the baby up on the mom and to sort of slow down the process and let there be a little bit of time before we cut the cord.
For bonding purposes, as much as maybe any health indications. In this research, though, has to questioning whether or not we should cut it quickly for health reasons.
Right. Many people want us to wait until it stops pulsing. And in this study looked at delaying that by about a minute to see if there's, or at least a minute, to see if it improves iron stores and hemoglobin levels of the babies, and also to see if it poses any risk to the babies or risk to the mothers.
You know, I find this research fascinating, and it's one of those reviews where they look at all the previous research and publish in a very influential Cochrane database of systematic reviews, which we can put a link up from our health science librarians. And the bottom line was this delayed clamping in all these different studies did not increase any risk of bleeding or blood loss or reduced iron counts of the mothers, and it did improve the iron counts of the infants.
Well, it's pretty impressive. They looked at 15 different randomized trials, about 4,000 women and infant pairs, so those dyads. And yeah, it improved the hemoglobin levels and the iron stores to the baby. There was a slight increase in jaundice of the babies, but otherwise...
That yellow color.
Yes, that yellow color. But otherwise, there was an increased risk to mom or baby and these potential real benefits.
And yellow can be mellow. That's not entirely benign. It can be serious. And I guess the bottom line is that this is going to continue, but I think more and more this will be closer to the standard of care. Certainly in emergency situations, you don't waste time.
Right. If the baby needs oxygen or assistance, I'm making that transition to the world, and sometimes we have to cut the cord a little bit sooner. But otherwise, I do think there's more of a shift towards just slowing it down.
Well, talk about slowing down and cutting the cord. This next research about exercise and obesity was a good news, bad news picture. I'm really happy, but not so happy.
I know. This was in the online journal Population Health Metrics, and they basically were looking at surveys and data from different counties in America and found that overall, Americans are exercising more, which is the good news, but the obesity rates continue to climb.
Right. And the good news, it was even further that in some of the areas of the country, like the Southeast and Kentucky, where statistically people exercise the least, had some of the largest gains in exercise, but there was no decrease in that obesity rate, which really suggests to us, and it's what we've known as doctors, that you really have to lose weight. You have to cut down on your calories. Exercise is important, but it's not enough.
Exactly. It's one piece of it. I think considering that more than a third of U.S. adults and about 17% of children in our country are obese, that this is something that we need to continue to give attention to, both with exercise and weight loss.
Unless we think that the United States has got this perfectly solved, in some of the worst areas in the country with our exercise and obesity, I thought it was shocking, Christy, that the lifespan in some places in the United States was worse than in countries like Vietnam, Yemen, and Sudan. We still have poverty that we need to correct in the United States.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk about another problem, and this is head trauma or concussions in teenagers.
Right. So this research that was actually a letter in the Journal of the American Medical Association by our colleagues up north, you'll hear us talking about this a lot because our colleagues up north are publishing some really good research, looked at students in grades 7 through 12, a questionnaire that they had filled out about how many of them had experienced head trauma.
And they found that 20% of the respondents who answered the survey at some point in their average 15 years of life had been hospitalized overnight or it had some sort of significant blow to the head that knocked them out for more than 5 minutes. So one in five teenagers has probably suffered a traumatic brain injury, according to the survey.
And why this is really important is that if you have had a traumatic brain injury, you tend to have some problems potentially with school and grades, with alcohol and substance use. And so it's a marker for following people's health much closer. And also it's a marker for, boy, we need to try to prevent this.
Yes.
You know, I know that one of my children had a traumatic head injury when they fell off someone's shoulders when they were 4 years old. No one told us that this could be something really serious for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. Luckily, it was not.
Well, my mom likes to blame pretty much everything on the time she dropped my sister on her head when she was a baby. Now she's a Superior Court judge, but even still, my mom blames it all on that one bit of head trauma.
How's that make you feel, Christy?
It's pretty funny.
Well, our last talk about feelings, our last research that matters is a really fascinating article in an interesting journal called the Journal of Affective Disorders, or a journal of disorders about depression, anxiety, and lots of things like that.
So they looked to see this connection between faith and belief in God and their response to therapy for depression, anxiety, or bipolar disorder, or other sort of common mental health diagnoses.
And they enrolled 159 men and women who were getting what's called cognitive behavioral therapy, or really therapy, 10-day-long sessions in a group setting and in an individual setting, along with some medication, and really looked at to what extent do they believe in God, and to see if that belief in God led to better success in the therapy.
And in fact, about 80% of the participants reported some belief in God, and those who rated their faith or their spiritual belief as most important to them, in the end, were less depressed after treatment and had more response overall effect to treatment than those who had little faith in God.
So those who believe that the treatment is going to help them were more likely to see it as credible and real if they also believed in God. Now, that doesn't mean that we can stimulate belief in God, but it does suggest that if you are entering therapy, a reasonable question to find out is, do you believe in God? And if you do, there's a good chance that this therapy will be more successful. That's one thing that I think would be very useful.
I also thought it was an interesting factoid reading about this is that most Americans believe in God, 92%. But yet among psychiatrists, only 65% have reported belief in God compared with 77% of other doctors. So I wonder if there should be further study, too, of if it matters of the faith of the patient and the faith of the doctor. I don't know.
Well, we're going to have two faith representatives on our show in a couple weeks, Christy, talking about their new book about faith and healing. I look forward to having that conversation. But that'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a good chance to talk about faith and therapy.
And about concussions in teenagers.
About you got to lose weight by cutting back as well as exercising.
And some potential benefits in delaying umbilical cord clamping at birth.
We'll take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Daniel Ofri, Associate Professor at New York University, about our new book, What Doctors Feel. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Daniel Ofri, Associate Professor at New York University School of Medicine, about her new book, What Doctors Feel.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Ofri.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
You know, I guess the question really that we always like to know is what made you decide to write a book about doctors' feelings? Because you know what? We're never supposed to feel anything.
Well, I would say I didn't actually plan to write a book about doctors' feelings. Hmm. I've written a few books over the years just about experiences that I've had. You know, when I started as an attending at Bellevue Hospital, the first thing I did was get sucked into a faculty project. We were writing a book, a textbook, an evidence-based medicine textbook, which I loved, on primary care. But it made me realize how little is actually evidence-based of what we do. I mean, much more of the things that we do are based on what we've learned, what we've heard, gut feeling, experience. And so I became curious about how much that plays a role in how we treat our patients. And so as I read more, I realized and spoke to more doctors that emotions do play a very large role.
And, you know, from we're all doctors having this conversation, so to us it is logical that we're human beings and that naturally we have feelings that impact how we interact with our patients, which is a large part of what we do. But how does the feeling of a doctor play a role, positive or negative, in that relationship? And you're talking more also from the patient's perspective of sort of understanding this concept that physicians are humans with feelings.
Well, you know, most of us could probably, you know, if we were sick, punch in our symptoms into a computer, and I bet the computer would spit out a pretty accurate diagnosis. But I don't think we'd feel particularly taken care of or healed. And so I think that most patients and even physicians would not want that, would much prefer a human being, a nurse or a doctor, taking care of them. But once you have two humans in the room, you know, emotions come into play. Whether or not you put much stock in it, you know, it's there. We're not a computer. So I think that there's a perception that doctors are completely rational. But I think, as you well know, doctors are not at all rational.
Well, I think that one of the problems is, of course, that how we were trained. And while we might have some age differences between all of us, a lot of us, and still the training of medicine is one that emphasizes science over emotions. And isn't there this still a concern that if you are really in touch with your emotions, you're not scientific?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think we've all trained that when we have the evidence, we should be using it and using the great scientific literature. But lots of it doesn't come down to that. For example, when we're helping patients through a particularly difficult moment in their life, you know, facing a traumatic diagnosis, we have evidence about what to do in terms of treatment, but often not how to help them face a frightening illness. And that's where I think our human instincts and emotions come into play. And I think it matters what our experiences have been. If we've just experienced the loss, the death of a patient, we may treat the next patient differently. Maybe we're a little afraid to invest again because we don't want to be hurt, even though we know we should, we may pull back. Or let's say we've just experienced a bruising lawsuit. Many of us, after a lawsuit, are very leery of getting involved with complicated patients, getting deep into the muck with patients. We may practice more defensive medicine. So our patients are on the receiving end of how what our emotional experiences have been.
And you say in your book that students are told that emotions cloud judgment. And then there's this element of doctors being taught to distance themselves and have certain barriers with their patients, which to some degree is appropriate. But talk to us a little bit about what we're teaching our student doctors about creating those barriers.
Well, it's interesting. I think that students hear one thing in their lecture hall about professionalism, empathy, connection, respect, but when they're actually in the hospital on the ward, I think they get very different messages, something we call the hidden curriculum. They see that doctors often aren't that attentive to patients and may treat them disrespectfully, especially if the illnesses are perceived to be self-inflicted, like drug use or alcoholism or obesity. And I think that students see those barriers coming up, even if they've been taught otherwise. You know, they see how doctors actually talk to patients, how doctors actually talk to nurses and other staff members, what kind of jokes they crack, you know, in the conference room. And I think it does really have a negative effect on our trainees.
So if doctors, and I think we would all agree, we have certain opinions about taking care of alcoholics and drug addicts and those who are really markedly different perhaps than we are, how does this affect the way we might care for the patient?
Well, it's interesting. You can see it very most clearly in studies of empathy. Empathy is one of those oddball things. We kind of know it when we see it, but it's hard to really measure. You know, empathy we define as being able to see from someone else's perspective. But in fact, they've developed some ways of measuring empathy, scores that give us some measure of how skillful doctors are in empathy. And patients of doctors who score high on these empathy levels actually do better in many hard clinical outcomes. Their diabetes can be better controlled, their cholesterol, often depression is better controlled, even the common cold seems to be shorter in patients whose doctors have better empathy skills.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, and I think we try, I'm sure your students and our students, we try to teach empathy and how to do empathetic statements. How does the practice of empathy, though, differ than the practice of compassion, which is really a really strong emotion? How does that play into each other?
Well, they're intrinsically related, having compassion, but having empathy, one critical part of empathy is being able to communicate that to the patient. So it's well and good if you have compassion and feelings for your patient, but if you can't convey that, if the patient doesn't understand that their caregiver does have compassion for them, then it almost doesn't count. So there are communication skills that are part of empathy that are very key. A patient's got to feel that someone is understanding them and not just be understood. And those skills can be taught or they can be absent.
Well, that was exactly my next question is, you know, sometimes we have a student who's done very well in school and has made it and wants to do good things in the field of medicine, but doesn't come with those raw skills of communication and expressing their own empathy. And I wonder what you've learned about to what degree it can be taught and how best to handle those who may not generate that kind of empathy and compassion naturally.
Well, these are the kind of things that are very hard to teach in a classroom or with PowerPoint. It really is when you're in the process of seeing a patient. And so when the attending or the supervising physician is with the patient who's having a difficult time and does demonstrate empathy, they also need to turn around to the student and say, you know, did you notice what I did? You know, I sat at the patient's level. I made eye contact. I put away the computer for the moment. I asked open-ended questions, all these things that may be intuitive for a very wise and experienced clinician, but may not be for the beginning doctor who may need someone to point out, here, these are the things I did. You know, I didn't interrupt. I kept my mouth shut for the first 2 minutes. All these small things go a long way to communicating to a patient that someone is listening respectfully, attentively, which is demonstrating caring about their situation.
You know, we're going to need to take a short break. But when we return, I'd like to pick up on this idea as one of my mentors described displaying maximum empathy. as well as this challenge you laid out earlier about doctors are humans and this legal challenges, and you have some stories to share. We'll take a short break, but when we continue, we'll be talking with our guest, Dr. Danielle Ofri, Associate Professor at New York University, about her book, What Doctors Feel. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Danielle Ofri, Associate Professor at New York University School of Medicine, about her new book, What Doctors Feel. And Dr. Ofri, we were talking before the break about ways to train our young doctors and to role model displaying empathy to our patients and the importance of that in terms of patients being truly cared for. I wonder if you have words of wisdom in your path about how we also teach doctors to be able to give that much of ourselves with each patient every 20 minutes to display maximum empathy within the pressures of being human beings ourselves.
Well, I was thinking, we talked a bit before, how empathy is often the most challenging in patients for whom their illnesses appear to be self-inflicted, people with addictions mm-hmm. and obesity. And we have a lot of alcohol and drug addicts in our hospital. We're a city hospital. And I see otherwise very empathic young doctors really lose that when it comes to these particular patients. And it's understandable. I mean, these are very difficult patients. They don't ever seem to get better. Your help seems to go into a black hole. And one morning on attending rounds in the hospital, you know, usually the team presents the most interesting case or the most complex case. But we had a drug addict who was admitted for the 57th time for another drug overdose. And I can see in the chart, the house staff just copy and paste the admission. It's the same every time. I said, why don't we see Mr. Corello, not his real name, you know, arguably the most boring patient on service. And I thought, we'll find something to learn from his case. So I took them into his room, and, you know, it was exactly as expected. It was a guy who was pretty down on life and answered everything with one-word answers and grunts, and really were getting nowhere. And I could sense the team shuffling, getting impatient, thinking, oh, they're going to really hate me. And then I thought of a question I'd never thought of before. I said, Mr. Corello, you know, we see patients when they're ill, and we see them when they're healthy, but we doctors are almost never present at the precise moment they cross over that border. Could you tell us the exact moment when you knew that you were addicted? He looked at me and said, oh, yes, there was an exact moment. And he began to tell this story. He was driving uptown on the Henry Hudson Parkway in Manhattan, going to see his nephew, his favorite nephew, for a birthday party. And then all of a sudden, he wanted a hit. He needed his drugs, and he remembers the car. He turned it around, heading downtown again. And he said, it was as though God reached out a hand and flicked my car back downtown, and I've been going downtown ever since. He said, once that happened, I knew I was addicted. And after that, the room was pin drop silent. Every student, every intern was spellbound by the story he told. I think because suddenly we could have some inkling of what it might feel like to have forces greater than you exert control over your life and be powerless to change. And I don't delude myself that our one moment of connection will cure his addiction. But it's hard to imagine how he'd have any chance of curing without some connection with his physician.
You know, that's a powerful story, and this idea of having experiences kind of greater than you. I think as physicians, we are exposed to so many things but don't have a place to put it. Can you mention, what do you recommend from your experience and in your book for dealing with death? From, you know, physicians, we do deal with death, perhaps more so than the general public. And that has a very powerful, larger than ourselves feeling. What do we do with those feelings? How do we process them?
Well, we do need to process them. Whenever anyone dies, patient, family member, friend, these are traumatic experiences, and we have to at some point give them their due. Otherwise, they'll come back and haunt us later. Now, it may be talking with a respected colleague or, you know, a good friend at work who can relate. It may be talking with family at home. It may be taking some time, a few moments of quiet time, so closing the door and having a chance to just have those feelings exist. For some people, writing is very helpful, writing it down, just writing the story and memorializing it in your own words. Some people find other artistic outlets of some type, music or drawing. But I think it's important that these are real feelings. Even though it's an occupational hazard that in medicine some of your patients will die, it doesn't mean that it's not a difficult moment and that we shouldn't give it its due. And I've seen a few programs now begin to set up spaces for doctors to share these. There is one program at University of Rochester in which the oncology service meets weekly. It's mandatory for the fellows, oncology fellows, but anyone, secretaries, nurses can attend. And there's, you know, time to talk about this. There's also a moment to mention patients who have died and just to share that moment out loud, give it some tribute, let people hear that you had someone close to you who died. And for many people, even those small things are enough to help the grief still be there but not overwhelm you.
Nice.
One of the things that we do in our program is talk with our doctors in training about guarding against cynicism and some of the challenges of wanting so much to fix the problems, to fix the situation that our patients are in, and some of the discord and feelings that we have when we can't fix it, which is pretty much, you know, most of it, and trying to celebrate the journey and the importance of walking with our patients. And some of that, I think, is some you're talking about a process of not just recognizing one's life, but celebrating the privilege it is to have that kind of journey with our patients. I wonder to what degree you think that is important in our training.
I think it's critically important, especially in the primary care field, where we often, you know, big things often don't happen on the daily basis in primary care. It's a long, slow journey, and things often happen incrementally. And we have to sometimes give ourselves credit for these small victories that, you know, if a patient's, you know, arthritis is a little bit better because you help them get inserts for their shoes and their feet hurt less. Well, you haven't cured their arthritis, but their feet hurt a little bit less. You know, that's worthy of celebration and acknowledgement. That's a success.
We're talking with Dr. Danielle Ofri about her new book, What Doctors Feel. And I guess in our remaining moments, Dr. Ofri, maybe one final question about, you stated in your book that doctors often don't get the distinction between curing and healing, but patients do. What do we need to ensure from your book to help doctors really see and ensure that their patients feel healed?
I think that emotions are an underlying baseline in our interaction, no matter what it is we're doing. You know, it is there from our patient and from us. And that being attentive to that can often be what provides the difference between curing and healing. Yes, you can give the patient antibiotics and cure their urinary tract infection, but that little attention to the patient's anxiety, to maybe your response to that, you know, one extra note of attention to that can then make the difference of the patient feeling like they're being taken care of, not just being dispensed a prescription. And I think for the doctor, you then get that back from the patient, that relief of feeling healed. You've done something. You haven't just, I mean, a computer could give it a prescription too, and you want to feel like you offer more than that. And again, that little attention to what's beyond just the prescription will also make you feel like you're doing something that's very valuable.
Well, I love that because in our field in family medicine and research, you're always trying to just advance things by one little small step at a time. And I love this small step. It doesn't feel overwhelming. So I feel good listening to that.
I feel good, too. Thank you for writing this book and for taking time to share it with our listeners. We'll certainly put information about the book on our blog. And I imagine people can get it on Amazon.
Sure, they sure can. And they can also, you know, my website has a lot of excerpts and things, danielleofri.com. I'd also love a mention to your listeners about the Bellevue Literary Review. that's our homegrown literary magazine that publishes poetry and fiction about health and healing, kind of the creative look at some of these issues.
Wonderful.
And if any one of you are interested in a review of reviewing the book, I don't know if you have it already, but you are certainly welcome to get a copy. If anyone.
We do, and we'll probably put a book review of it up on Your Health. So we want to thank Dr. Daniel Ofri for being our guest today about her new book, What Doctors Feel. We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, please send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
We've got some great questions today. We're going to talk about weight loss drugs, about coffee and stomach ulcers,
about a baby and a scalp rash,
and about hiatal hernias.
And we'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica, to please tell us our very first house call today.
I have almost hit my goal weight, but the last few pounds will not come off. Can you suggest any diet pills?
Oh, I get this question often because it's so frustrating if you've done such a good job. And congratulations, by the way, for having lost weight and almost hit your goal weight. And those last few pounds can be really troublesome.
And the advice we're going to give you may not be totally satisfactory to you, which is, unfortunately, the approved medications for weight loss are really not at that last 2 or 3 pounds for goal weight. It's not those last couple pounds. They're really for folks who are 10, 20, 30, 50% above their ideal body weight, where we think about medications. Though there is an over-the-counter medication, since it's over-the-counter, you could try.
Right. I would caution you to say that most of the medicines that are available, there's orlistat and phentermine, these different medicines, there are side effects, some of them potentially serious. And all of the data would say that it might help you lose 5 pounds or so. But after you stop taking the medicine, people typically gain it back unless you've had some major lifestyle change.
Right. And I think that lifestyle change is the best way of losing that final weight, which is perhaps cutting back a little bit more in your caloric intake or changing the types of foods that you're eating. Is there something that you can give up? So, for instance, myself, I will disclose, when I give up ice cream and I have frozen yogurt, I eliminate 400 to 500 calories a week. Mm-hmm. That's a significant amount of extra calories. Mm-hmm. Helps me lose just a little bit more weight.
Mm-hmm. And people who give up beer, or if you drink wine, like, those are just calories that go in that aren't serving any real purpose.
You can do light beer. Can you do light wine? Is there such a thing?
I don't think so.
We'll have to find out about that one. It may not be very good, but we'll try out. Well, hopefully that's an answer, even if it's not completely satisfactory. And congratulations on almost reaching your goal weight. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to our very next house call, Erica.
I drink 4 to 6 cups of coffee a day. Will that increase my risk of forming peptic ulcers?
We talk about coffee all the time on this show, and if you'll listen back, you'll find all kinds of potential benefits for your 4 to 6 cups of coffee a day. With respect to stomach ulcers, it's a little bit of a confusing answer.
And we wonder a little bit why the question's coming up. Maybe you're actually having some what's called dyspepsia, or upset stomach, a fancy term for upset stomach. And that maybe could be due to the coffee. And so, you know, we would have a long conversation about that. But if you're really just worried about a peptic ulcer, like your mother said, you know, don't drink so much coffee, you're going to get an ulcer. Well, the good news is there's not a strong association between that coffee and that ulcer.
So if it's bothering your stomach, then we'd say back off on it and see if it makes a difference. There is a chance that it influences people's acquiring H. pylori, which is a bacteria that can predispose you to get ulcers, but there's really not a direct link between getting coffee and getting ulcers.
In comparison, there are some things that you, if you were doing, we would say stop doing them, like drinking alcohol or smoking. These are things that are known risk factors for ulcers. So thank you for that question. It's a good one. and we hope that you never have a peptic ulcer. What's our very next house call, Erica?
My baby has a large, greasy area on his scalp that looks like scales. What is it, and how can I get rid of it?
Wow. Well, they would oftentimes say that a picture is worth a thousand words, but we don't have a picture here. We have a mental picture here, Christy.
We do. And what it sounds to me, and the most common thing, is something called cradle cap. And we can ask our excellent Health Sciences Library to post a picture of cradle cap and some information about it on our blog. This could be distressing to the parents because it looks kind of icky, but it doesn't bother the baby in most cases.
And there aren't a whole lot of other things that really are kind of greasy areas on the scalp of young children, really infants. And so that part's the good news. And this cradle cap is actually fairly easy to treat. A lot of times the old-time recipe that I heard when I came into medical school was take a little bit of Johnson's & Johnson's baby shampoo and just get those scales off there and rub it on there. And I guess you clean the scalp at the same time and wash those scales off. And that sometimes works.
Yeah, you can take a little soft toothbrush and kind of just sort of work it around in little tiny circles on the scalp. And then if there are some really stuck-on scales, you know, they're really going to go away eventually. And so I would try not to obsess over it too much.
Yeah, and I don't know either one of us necessarily recommend the prescription medications. There are some steroid creams that sometimes can be used, some over-the-counter 1% hydrocortisone cream. But most of the time, just you get those scales off there, and things do just well. Good luck.
Let's take our last house call question of the day. Erica?
My husband experienced three hiatal hernias in the last few years. I've read that they are most common in women, obese people, and those over 50, which he has none. Why is he experiencing this?
Well, first off, hiatal hernia, as Erica just discovered, that's not an easy thing to say. And it's a condition I don't think most people actually have heard of.
No, so a hiatal hernia, it sounds kind of bad, but it just happens when a part of your stomach sort of pushes upward towards your diaphragm or through your diaphragm, which is that layer that sort of separates the upper part of your chest and the lower part of your abdomen. And it usually just has a little small hole opening in the diaphragm through which that food tube or stomach area passes, can push up in there a little bit and then come back down. And in most cases, a lot of people have this and don't even know it.
And the fact that he had multiple one of these, I don't know if they were multiple ones or the same one that people discovered at different times when they did the x-ray, because these things can get very large. It's possible that they can expand. And if they expand, the contents can actually come completely up from the stomach, even into and around the esophagus and the trachea, and can even compromise people's breathing difficulties. But usually they're not that severe. Why did he get it? I don't know.
It is more common in smokers, and some people will get sort of chest pain and some symptoms from it, as you're alluding, Adam. But most people, this is sort of a good news in that if they find something, it's something that doesn't tend to cause major problems from people.
Common sense questions. We really appreciate them. And if you have any questions that you want to send to us, please, again, send them to UNC in care of Your Health, or send them to our website at yourhealth@unc.edu.
So thank you for the questions we've had today about weight loss and coffee and cradle cap and about hiatal hernias. And we're looking forward to hearing your questions. So send them to us.
So thank you for joining us today, and we want to hope that you join us again next time. We appreciate all of your questions and stories. If you want to visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app, just search Your Health, one word, for a free download.
We want to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Danielle Ofri. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
We look forward to talking to you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.